Philip Morgan, how are you, my friend?
Hey, listen, I'm good. Doing good. I mean, let's be honest, I'm a little tired. It's the end of the day, and I've been on the phone all day, so we'll see if my voice holds up. But I am feeling quite good about things.
You're cross-eyed. You have a cocktail. You have a cigar hanging out of your mouth and a smoking jacket. You look a little fried, Philip.
Thanks, man.
I just made up that cartoon image, by the way.
That's how you want to see me. I know it is. That's how you imagine me when the video's not on the Skype call.
You know what? That's how I wish I was right now. Especially the cigar and the cocktail in hand. But I do have a cocktail here.
Nice.
But so last time, Philip, we talked about connecting with influencers. And somewhere...
Boy, did we.
We did. But we didn't talk it all the way through. Somewhere along the way, we decided we needed to go deeper on this subject. And so we were talking about connecting with influencers. We really talked about two things. One is, what is an influencer? So someone who has an audience that pays attention to what they say, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part is, and we started to scratch the surface of this, how do I connect with them? Now, that turns out to be the bigger question. And you challenged me at the end of that episode, and you said, this is where the deep thinking and the empathy and being in someone else's shoes really comes into play. You want to talk a little bit about that? Because it's a big issue.
Yeah, it is. I think there's two aspects to it. There's sort of the mechanics of how, which I feel like a lot of blog articles try to speak to that, right? They're like, this is so great. You know, influencers can just change your business if you can develop a relationship with them or cultivate a relationship with them. That's obvious, I think. Or once you think about it, it's like, seems head-slappingly obvious. And the mechanics are, don't be a dick. Don't be a dummy. You know, don't just like be a one-sided taker and ask. And that sort of superficially answers the mechanics question. I feel like it gets, though, much more difficult when you get to the other half of that question, which is, how do you make it some kind of win-win, would be, I guess, the easiest way to phrase that. And there's a kind of a question that I feel like is, and I hope this is a good starting point. I know we want to get into some examples as we go through this, but here's the starting point question. Is there some threshold over that you have to be past in order for it to even be worth your time to reach out to an influencer? So let's say that I am a freelancer of some stripe, self-employed person of some stripe, and I feel like, boy, if I could really make this influencer outreach thing work, it'd be great. But do I have to have like something to give that influencer's audience, or are they just going to tell their audience about me and say, hey, if you need, you know, some lawn ornaments installed, you should hire this guy, you know, who does lawn ornament installation. You see what I'm saying? Is there some threshold of, you have to have like kind of your own thing going on for them to want to promote you?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think the answer is yes. So when you first said, is there some threshold? I thought what you were hinting at is, do I need the influencer to be beyond X big,
right,
you know, a reach of 100,000 or
right,
5,000 in order for it to be worth my time?
Right.
Well, the answer to that, I think, is how exact is their audience and homogenous is their audience. So okay, if they have only 1,000 people, but they would all be your ideal customer, that's fine, right? But if they have 100,000 and maybe 1% of them are your ideal customer, really, in essence, that's of the same quality as the 1,000 audience person.
Okay.
Okay. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I do believe you need to have an original thought or a unique take or a controversial idea to share. Now, Philip, you're focused on positioning, and I think it really starts there.
Right.
Is, how did I build my, I don't know if brand is the right word, but how did I build kind of the image that I leave in people's minds, the position, and then how do I tie messages to that that I can go share? So what I'm advocating for is what I'm calling the opening act strategy. I can go play for a headliner, someone who already has a platform, they draw an audience, and I'm going to go share my content with that audience. Now, that content has to be really good.
Okay, so to stop you right there, to use that analogy, you don't say, hey, I would love to be a performing musician. I have this song I wrote 5 years ago and have never sung. I'm going to try to open for, you know, some band that's actually successful, right? You don't start there. You have to be, there is a threshold of quality or of substance in your act to even be somebody else's opening act.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, I wouldn't start with a giant band. I would kind of work my way up, because the truth is, just like a musician, it's going to take you a little while to develop your stage show and build your presence and really understand how do I thrive in this setting of however you're presenting your content, whether it's through writing or live presentation, which I think might be the most powerful. But yeah, you're going to want to perfect your act a little bit. So okay. I would take some time to do that.
So you have to have something. I'm not sure we touched on this, and that's why I'm kind of, forcing you to bring this out, is you have to have something that you've kind of packaged that can be pitched or talked about as a thing. You can't just say, I'm a great freelance X, you know, whatever it is you do. You should tell your audience about me. I'm amazing. I'm just the best copywriter that I know.
Yep.
So you should tell, you kind of have to have a thing that's separate from you, because the thing is part of the exchange, or it's sort of part of what you're going to be pitching this influencer, right?
Yeah. So I'll give you a perfect example of what would never work. If you went to Envision, which is the one of the main pieces of software that designers use to do web pages and get comments and all that.
Yeah.
And you said to them, hey, I develop websites. You should have me on to talk about how to develop websites.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to say, who cares? Everybody who uses our software already does that, right? Like, what's different about you? What what's your thumbprint, right? What's different or interesting, or what stands out about you, or what unique contribution can you give? So I agree with you. I think this is a really strong point. This strategy will not work. But also, I would point out, your business will never thrive until you can articulate what that unique, fresh, interesting, different thing is about you.
Right. So it's not your winning personality, no matter how wonderful that is.
That helps, though.
Right. That's the vehicle that you're going to have to express this thing through. But that's not the thing. The thing has got to be a... I'm trying to make a point here that what I've noticed about the dynamic of, hey, I want to connect with this person who's got a large audience and get something in front of them that benefits both them, their audience, and me, you got to have that thing. And that thing has to be sort of, it doesn't have to be a book. It doesn't have to be a course. It doesn't have to look like a product. It could be just a bold idea.
Yes.
Or you said an original thought, a unique idea, a compelling idea. But it has to be like, it has to kind of have its own existence apart from you.
I'll give you an example. So whenever an author tours for selling their book, typically what they'll do is they'll pick the one idea that seems the most counterintuitive or against the status quo that they can find in their book, and that'll be the main thing that they talk about. So here's an example that your audience may be familiar, or our audience, I should say, may be familiar with. Our audience of 12, as you like to say. Jason Fried wrote a book called, I think, Rework. Yeah. And it was all about how a collection of their blog posts about how they like to promote the workplace and the way people work and the methods that they use to work at Basecamp.
Yeah.
And the thing that he talked about probably the most when he was touring to promote that book was that he thinks that no one should ever, under any circumstance, work more than 32 hours in a week. That should be plenty. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do great work in 32 hours, you need to reevaluate what's going on at your company. Mm-hmm. There must be a structural issue.
Right.
That is, I mean, granted, it's not the 4-hour work week.
Yeah.
But very counterintuitive for a CEO to go out and say that. So yeah. that, you know, not only does Jason have his own platform, but that idea caught the attention and interest and sparked the imagination of the audience when they heard it.
And it's not the only idea presented in that book. It's the one, but it was the sort of hook or the handle that right. he picked so that the book could become comprehensible to people who'd never heard of it, or it could be expressed in a simple way so they could start to associate that idea with the book, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was the sort of beachhead of the book because it made the listener say, Jason has some really different ideas about how companies should operate.
Right. Maybe I should check out this book and find out more.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was the theme throughout.
Yeah.
But this idea happened to be both different enough and in line with the rest of the message that it made sense.
Yeah. So I think we should put a pin in that topic for later. I think that's another one to dig into is when I say that topic, I mean, how do you go from, well, I just, you know, I build websites for people. I write copy for people. I write software for people. How do you go from that to an idea of not of the scale of what Jason Fried is talking about, but of the same nature, like a sort of polarizing idea or a big idea or a compelling idea?
That is a gigantic question. I hope you have all the answers.
Well, I'm going to put it on our list of ideas.
Sweet. Yeah. So let's go back to connecting with influencers. So
yeah.
The way I think about this is it all really starts with who do I want to connect with? So, and when I say that, I don't mean which influencers. This is the key mistake most people make. They say, oh, there's this company or there's this person and they seem to be saying a lot of things that I like. I think I should go connect with them and do something for their audience. And my retort to that is always, well, do they have your perfect audience? And if the answer is no, then I would say, well, maybe there's someone better. Let's table that for a second. Maybe they are great, but let's start with which audience do I want? Who's in my audience? And then work from there and say, okay, who has that audience? So what audience do I want? Question number one. Once I identify that, question number two, what do those influencers want who have those audiences that I want access to? And question number three is, how can I help both the audience and the influencer and have something aligned to what I'm looking for? So this is all kind of abstract. So I'd really like to give some examples. And Philip, we are starting with you in the hot seat. Are you ready?
You bet.
Okay. So Philip, tell me if I'm on track. Your audience, when we ask question number one, what audience do you want? Your audience is a group of software developers who may be receptive to learning about positioning their business.
Yep. Demographically, they're self-employed is another sort of easy way to qualify them or describe them. And beyond that, the last part of what you said, who may be receptive, I don't even care about that, actually. If they're self-employed software developers, I know some things about them that give me a high degree of confidence that they will listen to something that's adjacent to the idea of what I talk about, which is they'll listen to me talk about lead generation as a door opener. So anyway, just to refine what you said, but basically, yes.
Perfect. And also thank you for that correction, because this idea of, you know, accessing an audience that's really open to my awesome idea, mm-hmm. like that would be great if we could identify them, but they may not even know the idea exists. And also, how are we going to know if they're receptive or not? So that's a really good distinction.
Yeah, they could throw rotten tomatoes. I don't care. But if they fit that demographic, there's a few people in there who will be like, tell me more, you know, after they hear about half of what I have to say.
Sweet. Okay, so that's the audience you want. Now, the next question is, who already has an audience of software developers? So in your case, you named a few people. John Somnes, did I say that right?
Yeah.
Joel Spolsky.
Yep.
Let's hear a little bit more about John and Joel. So why are they influencers? Who do they talk to? What's their message?
John started a blog a long time ago called Simple Programmer, and just for a long time, I mean, I think in internet time, you know, in internet time, a long time might be 3 or 5 years. I don't know exactly how long, but he just produced a tremendous amount of content. Did something like 20 or 30 courses on Pluralsight, this learning platform that's kind of like lynda.com, but, you know, not exactly like that, on various aspects of software development, and just built up a relatively massive audience, somewhere around maybe 50,000 people on his email list. So if you just look at that as a metric for his audience size, that's a pretty large audience. It's what is that? You know, I have 3,500 people on my email list, so that's 10 times bigger, mm-hmm. a little more than 10 times bigger.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's just the sort of snapshot of John. Joel Spolsky writes a very influential blog called Joel on Software. I think he was the founder of Fog Creek Software, which has produced some products that are pretty widely used in the world of software development. And he's kind of a sort of Jason Fried-like character in that he has real strong opinions that he does a good job of backing up about how you should hire and how you should run a software company. So I don't know as much about his audience, but he's very influential. And those are two examples of people who would be influencers for my audience. And the reason I know this, by the way, Liston, is not just that I know they're out there and I know they have X number of people on their list, but people who have been clients of mine reference them. Like I know directly from, you know, people who are good clients for me, they'll be like, oh yeah, did you read that, you know, Joel on Software article about X? So they're mentioning them in everyday conversation with me.
Right. Okay. So that's fantastic. So mm-hmm. we've got Joel and John. And then the last name you mentioned, we're still on the second question. Who are mm-hmm. the influencers and what do they want? Mm-hmm. The last person you mentioned was DHH. So before we get to DHH, David Hennemeyer Hansen.
Something like that.
We'll say it's close enough. But DHH is the guy who invented Ruby on Rails and co-founded Basecamp with Jason Fried, who mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier. Now, John and Joel, they both have an audience of people who they sell information related to being software developers to. Is that right?
Joel, I'm not sure. I think I don't know that he has products that he sells to his audience. He may be more one of those, you know, quote unquote, pure influencers who doesn't really have anything to sell because the company he founded is worth so much that that's his income or source of wealth or whatever. So him, I'm not as clear on. And also, I just want to say, for those who have not made it onto this list, there are other influencers out there.
Of course. This is not an exhaustive list. This is just for the benefit of the audience, right?
Yeah. Got to keep it simple.
So John sells stuff. Joel may not sell stuff. And for sure, so DHH focused on Basecamp. Yeah. I would say, like, my opinion is he's probably not a person who would do a collaboration using his platform to showcase you. Now, he'd probably come on to the Philip Morgan podcast, You could probably land him to do that, but he's probably not going to use his influence to showcase whatever you have to say.
With the one exception, and this would also be true, I think, of somebody like Joel Spolsky, is, yeah, maybe they might be on my podcast. And if they had a good time and they actually enjoyed it, they might link to it from Twitter or something like that, which is going to get the thing I'm doing in front of, you know, maybe a couple 10,000 people, you know, a couple tens of thousands of people, possibly. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just not to, you know, I'm not arguing with what you're saying, but that might be the sort of backdoor way that they would expose something I'm doing to their audience.
But you wouldn't be the opening act necessarily. They would just kind of give you an attaboy with a retweet or something like that.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, going to a show for some artist you love and they are like, you know, by the way, you should check it. Like, they just want to do a favor for some up and coming person that they like. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, you should check this person out.
Yeah. So let's look at each of these. So John, we talked about, he is selling things already to software developers. So information primarily.
Yeah.
And so he has a huge drive. So the question is, what does John want? And John wants to sell more stuff to software developers. And one of the ways to sell more stuff to software developers is to keep them constantly engaged in his content.
Right.
Now, you and I have used the same term, feed the content beast, because it is so demanding of our time. Someone like John has a huge need to create new stuff constantly. And after you've been at it for, I don't know how long John's been at it, let's say 5 years, 8 years, maybe 10 years.
Sure, yeah, something like that.
He probably doesn't have very many new things to say on a regular basis to his audience. Granted, right, a lot of people are showing up for the first time today or last month, but it's probably mostly been said. So one thing that you bring is you can feed the content beast. And the way you can help John is you bring a fresh perspective that maybe doesn't exist for his audience yet.
Right. Looking at his YouTube channel, just to sprinkle in some factoids here, 132,222 subscribers. Like some video there had 34,000 views. Anyway, yeah.
So pretty big reach. Now, right. Joel or DHH, so John would probably be open to something like, maybe not a webinar, but maybe a collaboration project where there's mutual content that you create. Maybe you complement, you know, you'll teach people how to position, and then he can upsell them on how to be more awesome developers or learn a new language. These things seem to go hand in hand.
Yep.
Joel or DHH, I'd say less of an opportunity for you to be that present in front of their audience.
Right. They're interesting cases because they have two audiences.
Right.
They have customers of their product. You know, let's use, I think the clearer example here is DHH and Basecamp, right? So his audience, in a way, are the customers he's trying to delight who pay every month to use Basecamp. And then there's this other audience of people who think he's freaking amazing because of what he's built. And because of his ideas and opinions and sort of who he is. But as far as I can tell, he doesn't really sell them anything.
Right.
And I'm not sure that he ever said, I want to have, you know, 100,000 developers think I'm God walking among men. You know, I'm not sure he ever had that thought.
I bet he didn't. I don't know him, but I'm going to guess.
Let's assume he didn't, because I'm going to assume that's actually a little bit rare. I think people who become influencers do it as it's an indirect result of some other goal they have. That's a theory I have about influencers, because I think if your goal is, I want to build a big audience and I want to be famous, you turn into such a shitty person that you'd never achieve that level of, you know, love by your audience.
Right.
Anyway, so we're getting a little sidetracked here. It's all my fault.
Well, so like I'm looking at his site, and he definitely has a following. And I know he writes on Signal V Noise, which is now on Medium.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, I don't think, in my mind, I don't think they have guests, like true guests, like a Philip who's not associated with their business.
Right.
So given the information that you just gave me, Philip, if I were your consultant for partnership marketing mm-hmm. and helping you with the opening act, I'd say, of those three, let's focus on John. So right. then the next question is, how can I help this influencer and the audience? And we talked about the fact that you can teach the audience how to run a more successful business. John gets free content. He also, his primary goal is to teach the audience how to be better at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So that's perfectly aligned. And the audience is there because they want to be better at what they're doing. So I absolutely hate the terms synergy and alignment and these like dumb corporate speak words, but you can see how all three people or all three of these stakeholders, I guess, in this scenario are all coming out ahead as a result of this.
It's a trifecta.
It is a trifecta.
Yep.
So I think that that's one example. Let me try to, what were you going to say, Philip?
I was going to say, that's great. Like, what I hope people got the sense of is, A, it's not simple. There's a little bit of even bordering on pain in trying to answer some of these questions to achieve that trifecta. Because that's really what you're going for, right, is that trifecta of the audience gets something great, the audience, the influencer or the owner, quote-unquote, of that audience or the custodian of that audience gets something great, and I get something good.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and let me give an example that's maybe a little faster just to walk people through mm-hmm. this. So I was working with a friend, Josh, runs a company called Sales DNA, sales training business. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to get in front of an audience of sales leaders. And so that was the audience he wanted, sales leaders. So VP of sales, director of sales, sales manager, sales enablement, sales leaders. Who has that audience? Now, salespeople use all kinds of tools. So this is one category I would break it into is like, mm-hmm. Where do people go for information? What tools do they use? What services do they use? All great categories to find mm-hmm. influencers. And so there's a company called Outreach that's the market leader in a particular type of sales tool. They have about over 200,000 website visitors. They have about, 50 or 60,000 on their email list. And so what they want, of course, is to sell software.
Right.
They don't run the content program purely because they want to pay it forward like DHH.
Right.
They run the content program ultimately to make their customers more successful and sign up more people to demos so that they can buy the software.
Right.
And so I went to them and said, hey, what if we did a webinar for your audience because you don't have content on selling mindset, even though we know that's about half of what contributes to the success of an individual salesperson. And ultimately, if people are successful, they're going to be stickier customers for you. And they mm-hmm. said, great, love it. Let's do that. So the audience I wanted was sales leaders. Mm-hmm. The influencer I wanted, Outreach, what they wanted is to convert more people from being a subscriber to getting a demo or make the product more sticky for existing customers. And the way we could help them both, or Josh could help them both, was by giving this webinar that taught them how to be more successful at doing their job.
And they went for it, right?
And they went for it. And that resulted in, 450 signups and 150 people actually attended. And then the leftover strategy, which we're not covering today, but there were 300 people who didn't attend, so I just created a list of them, sent it out, and said, hey, notice you couldn't make it to the original webinar. We're doing another one just for you. And then we got another 100 people to show up to that. Right. So there's a lot of opportunity there. And then, of course, now Outreach has come back to Josh and said, hey, we'd love to do another one. And they've asked us to write other articles and do much more for their audience. So now this is truly the opening act strategy where you get to play for the headliner over and over and over again.
Right. And that actually happens in music is, you know, they're like, wow, those guys were a great opening act. Why don't you come on tour with us? That kind of thing. You hear,
exactly.
Like I've read interviews with musicians where they said literally that. And that's how they get their start. So one, dive into the mechanics here. This was like an email to Outreach on, like you emailed them. How did you set this up? How did you handle that first contact?
Super good question. So I recommend starting small. So if I'm unknown and I get Googled and I'm still unknown, I wouldn't recommend going in and saying, why don't you dedicate a bunch of marketing resources to setting up a webinar with us whom you don't know and you can't verify, right? So what I said was, you know, I notice you're missing some content on your website. What if we wrote a couple articles for you? And then in the process of writing those articles, those were perfectly aligned with the webinar we wanted to give. I said, hey, do you guys want to do a webinar together? Like this article that I'm writing, we can turn this into an awesome multimedia presentation. Be way more engaging. You get people on, you can, you know, tell people how to get a demo. Like there's all these benefits for all of us. And that, so basically it started with the articles. I reached out to the content person. This is a great place to start. It's fairly easy still to do a guest post, especially for companies.
Right.
And then what I did was I asked for an introduction to the person who handles the webinars. And so I came with a warm introduction. Liston's great. He writes great content. You're going to love working with him. And so that was my first introduction to the person who handles the webinars. And then we worked with her and the VP of sales at this company in order to execute the webinar. So that's how it happened.
Okay. So you had like the equivalent of couple coffee dates before you asked them to spend more time with you.
Right.
In dating terminology.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the next example I'll use is myself. So my market is freelancers and consultants, and I want to help them minimize the, or let me rephrase that, maximize the impact of their marketing by developing just 5 relationships that are really going to pay off. And those can be partnerships, they could be referral sources. And so what I want to do is access this audience of freelancers and consultants. And so I know 2 people, present company included, who have this audience. And so I could skip the part about, I'll write an article for you. In fact, Philip, I believe you asked me if I would do another webinar for your audience, which I've done before, to great accolades, I may add.
Yeah.
I think. I don't know. You didn't share the reviews with me.
I kept all the accolades for myself.
As you are wont to do.
Yeah, you know, to kind of add some nuance to what you're talking about, I have a very small version of the feeding the content machine problem. I mean, it's, you know, it's a opportunity wrapped inside a problem or a problem wrapped inside an opportunity. I don't know. But like I'm always trying to find, it's not hard because I have a fairly decent network of people who are great podcast guest experts. But that's also part of what's going on is like, it's not like I'm like doing you a favor or anything. Like I need the content just as much as it's beneficial, I think, for you to have the exposure to my audience. So that's just another example of the feeding the content machine problem.
Totally.
The content beast.
And like with Outreach, you're already familiar with me.
Yep.
You know that if I say I'll be there at 9 o'clock on Tuesday, I'll be there at 9 o'clock on Tuesday, maybe 9:03. Let's be honest. I own that. And you know that, you know, I've presented this content and it's been received pretty well already.
Right. Exactly. Right.
So like you're not
all
taking
all the risk factors have like green check boxes, not red X's.
Right. And I did the same, you know, I talked to Kai Davis, another friend of ours, who also has this audience and also needs to feed the content beast. And it's good for him to switch it up a little bit, not just be the only voice to his audience and right. let them know there's fresh perspectives and, you know, Liston's not Kai and we have a little bit different idea, or Liston can talk about sales as a way to make these really close relationships in addition to marketing. And I bring that to his audience. So, yeah. You know, for me, these are two immediate examples that are going to happen in January where I'm giving a webinar. I'm the opening act for Philip and for Kai, and I'm accessing an audience that I want, freelancers and consultants. I'm giving something that they need, which is information about how to be more successful in the sales and marketing of their business. And I'm giving Philip and Kai what they need, which is to feed the content beast and to have a fresh perspective.
That trifecta all
the
over.
The trifecta.
That's right. Yeah, and I guess we maybe could wrap up with, do you have any examples? We sort of already touched on this, like some examples where I can't see a clear path to that trifecta, like me trying to get in front of Joel Spolsky's audience or DHH's audience. It just doesn't seem to work. There's not that trifecta. There's something in it for me, yeah. And maybe there's something in it for that audience, but it's difficult to make the case that it gets the three checkboxes checked off. Do you have other examples of that maybe are informative examples of where, or even just situations where you just know it's not going to work?
So I'd say the biggest one is if you're trying to access an audience that isn't already self-selected into a place or a following of some sort.
Huh.
So that would be one big one. So like maybe the question is, do you need to define your audience a little bit better?
Uh-huh.
But it, you know, if I wanted to access, you know, stay at home moms who run Shopify stores that sell knitting supplies.
Mm-hmm.
Are they, like, I could find them, but that's more of a sales thing. That's not an audience of people that I can access. So that would be one thing right. that I would say. That would be one. The other is, you know, I can't think of a specific example, but what I'm thinking essentially is if the person who owns the audience, if you can't give them what they need and have that aligned with what the audience needs, it's like that, obviously that's just not going to work. So I'd love to hear some examples, but I'll give you a counterpoint. I had someone who watched my webinar last week, mm-hmm. and it wasn't influencers necessarily. He was looking for referrals, but I think this is informative in the idea of redefining my audience or changing levels in the way I think about approaching things. Mm-hmm. So he's a home inspector, and he is marketing directly to realtors. And he said, I don't know how this is going to work for me. And so my question was, well, you're selling to realtors. They're your referral point. Because like I've bought a house. You've bought a house, mm-hmm. Philip.
Yeah.
You don't go out and shop for a home inspector. You just say to the realtor, who do you know? And they're like, I know Jane. Right. And I'm like, great, tell Jane to come over. I don't want to spend any time on this.
Right.
That's it. Like the home buyer doesn't think about it at all. And so it's all about the realtor. So I said, well, rather than thinking about marketing directly to the realtors, what if you market to brokerages where you teach them about common errors that are made in inspections, or you market it to your local realtor association,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and did information for them,
right?
Right? Or provided resources for them. And he went, oh, yeah, I never thought about that. So I think that's a good example where he thought, you know, this idea of performing for someone who has my audience, it would never work because he wasn't focused on the right level.
Right, right. He's trying to connect the wrong dots.
Exactly. And that is, to your point in the last episode, one of the challenges of this is it requires a lot of thinking, because you may not know what you don't know, but you have to continue to ask, why? Why won't it work? Why will it work? What more can I do?
I want to say on that note that I cannot see any downside to doing that kind of inquiry or questioning. In other words, let's say you do it and you just come up with nothing in terms of the partnership angle. It's going to have other benefits. Like, you can't know too much about your audience, I don't think. The people you're trying to serve or the people you're trying to reach, you just can't. So it's going to be beneficial no matter what. Listen, I think I'm going to blow your mind here. How many podcasts do you think are out there that are related to knitting? You mentioned knitting earlier.
Well, I know in internet marketing circles, I know it's quite a big niche. A lot of people sell to knitters because they're a very passionate bunch.
I can't guarantee these podcasts are active. Some of them are tangentially related.
Hold on.
I want your guess.
Let me guess.
How many do you think?
I would say hundreds. Say between 300 and 500.
There's close to 320 on somehow related to knitting. Cast.market is the site where you can pretty easily get a sort of topical list of podcasts. No guarantees about accuracy or anything like that, but still, I think for some people they're like, they're going to just have spit out their coffee when they hear that, because it seems impossible that there's that many focused on knitting. Like, knitting is no longer essential to the survival of the human race, right? Machines do that. Like, people don't have to knit anything. It's a hobby.
Right.
But there you go.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I just looked at, where do you see the number on here, by the way?
You don't, but there's 20 pages of results, and there's 16, entries per page. So, 16 times 20.
Sure. Yeah. I just looked at Freelancer and see that there's 19 of those pages.
Yeah. So that's pretty close to about the same number of podcasts. Looks like you got your work cut out for you, buddy.
To start spreading the message.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think so.
All of those are potential places for you to do this kind of trifecta. It's easier, I think, when you're a podcast guest, because there's usually not that prep work of, hey, let me write a couple articles for you or what have you. You were going for something, I think, that's a little higher up the impact scale when you did a webinar for outreach.
Right. Well, webinars are powerful because there's such a connection. They can see you. They can hear you. There's an expectation that you're going to pitch them.
Right.
These are all really powerful things. Okay, so now I'm going to blow your mind, Philip, and I think we'll end it here.
Okay.
So if I wanted to do a podcast tour for freelancers or consulting podcasts, how many podcasts do you think come up with a match to either freelancer or consultant?
I'll guess 500.
1,664.
Wow.
Yeah, that's kind of blowing my mind. I would need a scraper to make this thing work.
Oof.
So,
some of them are going to be abandoned or not take guests or whatever, but still, totally. It doesn't change the impact of that number of, like, really, there's like these 1,000 plus little micro channels that you can use to reach an audience. It's just phenomenal to think about.
Yeah.
Now, here's the next question. How many of those has Seth Godin been on?
All of them.
Half of them, at least.
All of them. Because he's the God to all of us.
Yeah, all of the good ones.
He's not the person I would like to emulate, but he's awesome. I mean, my daily blog is inspired by him. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Philip, I think we covered it. So I just want to recap really quickly, because I know we covered a lot.
Yeah.
The basic model that we're proposing here in terms of the nuts and bolts of how you're actually going to connect with influencers is three questions. Number one, what audience do you want? Number two, what influencers have that audience and what do they want? And number three is how can you help both the influencer and the audience and, of course, yourself? So did we do it, Philip?
We did, and we uncovered some interesting stuff to stick in the backlog to talk about later, and I'm happy about that too because I think this is it's something we can talk about at a sort of intermediate level in two podcasts, but I think it's actually a very – it's a kind of a big deal, and it's one of those things where I think you start to get into it and you uncover more questions and so it's a deep subject is what I'm saying.
Sweet. Yeah, I actually added two new cards to our Trello board during this conversation. So I think we got plenty of fodder here.
Nice.
Well, cool, man. Have a good night, Philip.
Talk to you later.
All right, bye.